Dove... Ralph White.
My name is Ralph White.
Ooh, shit. My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. Ooh, scared myself. And this journey through the steps we're talking about this morning is not the way to do the program. This outline in the big book. It's not the way. I'm going to share my experience with this 12-step process. We, our program, in addition to having 12 steps, we have 12 traditions and concepts. And you probably hear the traditions read all the time, and it talks about anonymity, you know, and it talks about is our 12th tradition. And a lot of times people get confused with that and think the anonymity has to do with the fact of maintaining the privacy of our members, and it does. That's a big part. But another feature of anonymity that's most important is the humility, that nobody speaks for this program. Nobody speaks for Cocaine Anonymous. Nobody speaks for alcoholism. And nobody's an authority. So when you hear me talking this morning, I'm going to talk about my experience. And I'm going to talk about my experience with this process. And that's pretty much what I'm going to share. I'm not going to be sharing a tutorial, and I'm not going to share a primer on the steps. I'm going to be sharing my experience with these 12 steps. And I've been on this journey for a minute. And so when we talk about these steps, Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, they started writing it in 1937. It's a trip because these days we talk and we really talk about newcomers. You need to be quiet. And there's a lot of merit in it because I don't think you would have wanted to put me in charge of writing a book when I was 2 years sober. That's how I know that God was involved in the process. Because when they started writing the book, the person who had the most amount of sobriety was only 2 years. Only 2 years. And so the first 100, when they started putting their combined experience together, you know, it was a bunch of people. Looking a lot like us, we tend to think it was this spiritual exercise, so we kind of think angels were dancing around the room and they were burning candles. No, they were drunks and they were dopey and they were talking shit and they were arguing and it was that kind of experience. And from their combined experience came this book. And when they put this book together, they said, we want this book to go out to people just like us. And the book was intended to be a standalone. If you were by yourself, you could read this book and duplicate what these people had done and get this process of recovery. Nowhere, the interesting thing about the book, we talk about the promises and all of the steps and we talk about everything else. We have a better idea because we have a larger sample size now. We've seen this. Much of what was written in the book was speculative. When they talk about these promises, a lot of what of it was optimistic. A lot of it was hopeful. A lot of it was speculative. A lot of it was based on some of these things that come to pass. But how do we know they're going to have any long-term effect? You think about it being written in 1937. So people hadn't, well, we now have the benefit, large sample size, of seeing, damn, something was at work here beyond the fingers that were penning this book. You can't see it when you're in it. You know, my sponsor always talks about life is lived forward, but it's understood backwards. And so looking back, we are able to see things they weren't able to see when they were putting pen to paper. So when they started writing the book, one of the things they said was, okay, it's a bunch of drunks, no credibility in the community, no credibility outside of us, ourselves. We don't even have a lot of credibility among ourselves. We're going to sell this book. Who's going to buy this book? So they said, when we put this book together, the first thing we're going to do is put a doctor on the front end, a respected doctor. You know, and they qualified the doctor. He's the head, you know, he specialized in alcoholism and drug addiction at one of the main hospitals in one of the major cities in this country, Dr. William D. Silkworth. He wasn't a quack. He wasn't one of these guys that you could go pay to give his opinion. You know, if you ever been in court and you hear experts get up there, whoever is paying the expert's going to testify on their behalf, right? Well, that's not what this doctor was. He wasn't one of these higher quacks. He was a doctor, and he was well respected, and he put a chapter in the front of this book. And at the front of our book, we said, okay, we're coming out with the credibility thing right out the chute so people will pay attention to us. And this doctor, Dr. William D. Silkworth, put in the front of our book the doctor's opinion. Now, when you go see a doctor, generally speaking, if he's not a shrink, if he's not a psychologist, if he's not a psychiatrist, if you go see a doctor, it's because you're suffering what? A physical ailment. Right? A physical ailment. Right there, we're going to start talking about something that's physical in nature. That's why we talk about the doctor's opinion, not the psychiatrist's opinion, not the psychologist's opinion, not the therapist's opinion. We have a doctor's opinion. Hint, something physically is wrong with me. What do we call a doctor's opinion when we go see a doctor? Generally, we go see a doctor. Doctor, is something wrong with me. And the doctor gives us what? A diagnosis. Doctor's opinion. The diagnosis by the doctor of what's wrong with Ralph White. So now we're going to talk about this doctor's diagnosis of what's wrong with me. And so the doctor writes these letters. And this is where we start finding out that it's something physically different. And what is it about me? And the way that I see it is not because the person wrote it in the book. I hear people say, I suffer from a disease. I suffer from an allergy, you know, because it says so in the doctor's opinion. If my mother reads the doctor's opinion, it doesn't mean she suffers from an allergy. Because she doesn't. I don't suffer from an allergy because the doctor says it. The doctor names what it is I suffer from. I suffer from an allergy because I have an allergy. The doctor gave it a name. If you ever saw, it's a movie I really like a lot, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. And then Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, they always have this phrase, and they give it a name. Give it a name. You know, and when I was out there, I couldn't give it a name. So when my experience shows I grow up and I start the regular progression. You know, I'm the kind of guy I grew up and I a lot of people in here are young. I started fairly advanced for our fellowship. I didn't start getting loaded till I was 16. And I started with drinking, not overnight alcoholic. I drank, it was cool, it was all right. Came out to shoot drinking. Some Yago, some Spinata, some Annie Greenspring, some Brass Monkey, some Boone's Farm. You know what I'm saying? Just drinking, you know, having fun, going out with my girl. And so it graduates. And then I start smoking commercial weed. you know, in the more red, you had a red roller, and I had yellow back zigzags, commercial weed. You know, I lived in L.A., so most of our weed came from Mexico, stem seeds popping all over the place, you know. And so I'm smoking my weed, and I'm drinking my alcohol, and I'm cool. No problems. Life is good. If you read Bill's story, I could track my story through Bill's story. I'm a young guy, and I'm a high achiever. I'm not one of the ones that came out, you know, already ditching school. That's not my story. I'm not one of the ones that came out already going to juvie. That's not me. I'm a schoolboy, and I'm a square, and I'm a shy guy, and I'm a high achiever, and I have dreams, and I have goals, and I have ambitions. I had two goals. My first goal was to wear number 30 and play shortstop for the Dodgers. You know, baseball was my game. Maury Wills was my idol. And my second goal, and I meant it, was to be the first black president in the United States. And people used to encourage me. I had an encouraging mom. I had a nurturing mom. I had an encouraging family, and I had an encouraging community. And I was a guy that achieved a lot of stuff, written up in the papers, all that, you know. So I'm off in the life. You know, and drinking and using started taking an important part in it. I graduated from high school smoking. So I started smoking herb the summer that I graduated from high school. And when I got to college and was off on my own, that's when I count really smoking herb is when I started buying my own weed. Until then, I don't really count it. You just smoke it every now and then. But when I started copping my own herb, and back in those days, it was three-finger nickels, four-finger dimes, no stems, no seeds, right? And that's how it was. You could cop a bird, you'd go copping pounds, keys, 2.4, 2.5 pounds, $125, $85 a pound. You know, I can remember just like it was yesterday. And that's when I thought. And I had goals to be the first black president. This disease is so insidious when it's progressive. All of a sudden, I can't tell you when, probably somewhere after my freshman year, my goals started changing a little bit. That first black, I started saying, I want to now graduate from using a red roller and two yellow zigzags. I want to roll one paper, one hand. That became a goal of mine. What that happened? First black president, one paper, one hand. Like my brother did, you know, one paper, one hand, you know. And I'm in the life, man, and life is good. You know, I'm having a good time. I'm partying, you know, and I'm part of life at last. Bill says that in a story. I was part of life at last. Drink started taking a more important and exhilarating part of my life. I'm grown. I'm 18. I'm in the dorms. I'm on my own. I'm grown. Still no problems with drinking and using. It started affecting me a little bit. I had 8 o'clock classes. I had to withdraw from them because I'm up all night. I'm up all night. My major was poli-sci, but you would have thought my major was in smoking weed, drinking, and Bed West, because that's what I was doing, you know. So I start doing that, and somewhere along the line, you know, it starts getting more and more important to me. In 1973, somebody offered me some blow, and I turned it down. That's dope. That's drugs. I don't do drugs. I'm on a fast track for success. I'm at a major university. I got my life in front of me. I got goals, and I have dreams, and I have ambitions. It got offered to me again a couple of months later. And this time it was from a guy who was playing on the football team. I'm at a major school. The guy that you watch that ended up playing on Sundays. And the guys that were getting down, too. I was at a school we were a major power at that time. Won 88 straight games in basketball. You know, we were the shit. And some of the guys from the team, I'm like, wow. And I'm with some guys, and I'm running with people who were going to be later on captains of industry, who were going to be political leaders in my town, in my state, and in this country, who were going to be people who we were going to be watching on Sundays, who we were going to watch during the... This is a status. This ain't nothing wrong with cocaine. I'm not sticking the needle. I'm not dropping pills. No, nothing wrong with this. And in those days, man, when you started snorting cocaine, if you didn't have at least a C note, don't even think about it. It was no people. You didn't see people at the gas station yet. You didn't see people running up to your car wanting to wash your windows yet. You didn't see people like that. You saw people. You had to know adult man. You call Bill, Ralph, come on. Let's hang up. No conversation. You just call. You go over there. You cop. It's coke etiquette. No thing. It's your turn. Album covers, mirrors, you know. No. Your turn, you know. Coke etiquette, you know. And you go in places, and you go into the best clubs, and you go into the best spots, and you go to parties. And I would go upstairs. I wouldn't even know they were partying downstairs. The party would be over. I'm still upstairs with the elite crew, right? And that's how I'm rolling. And so, but now it's starting to get more and more out of control for me. And I'm blowing, and I'm this is snorting cocaine. So now I'm snorting cocaine, I'm smoking weed, I'm smoking hash, or, you know, I'm doing the thing, and I'm in life. When Bill talked about people chattered in millions and were spending in time, you know, that was, you know, we talking big shit, right? You know, we rolling, we think we you know, we running with women, we in the best parties, we clubbing. I used to give some of the best parties, and you couldn't have told me. So I graduate from school, and I start working as a counselor for LA City Schools, and then things start happening to me. I had a kind of job that allowed me to work away from the office. I worked in the field. I had all these elementary schools, all these junior middle schools and high schools that I was supposed to be a campus advisor to. So I would call in and say, I'm at Gompers Junior High School, or I'm at Fremont. I'm at home. I'm playing softball, you know, I'm smoking weed. And pretty soon that caught up with me, and I got let go from my first job. And I blamed it on Thursday paydays. Then never made the connection between my drinking and my using. Never made the connection between that. Blamed it on Thursday paydays. Then it got to the point where I lost my first job. I started working at another job. The doctor talks about, you know, and he describes what it is that I suffer from as an allergy. And he said it in a strange way. You know, he says that once this person, and he talks about it in a couple of places in the doctor's opinion. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as this soundness may, of course, mean little, you know. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that the explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which I cannot otherwise account. Now, I have an allergy. How can I have an allergy? Anybody in here allergic to anything? What? Everything. You don't count. Everything. Huh? Penicillin. Do you go out looking for penicillin? What do you do with penicillin? Stay away from it at all costs. Who else is allergic to something? What are you allergic to? What is it? Oh, I don't even know what that is. I was allergic to oranges, and they broke me out. I liked them, but I stayed away from them because I did not like breaking out and the rash that I broke out in. So how can you tell me I have an allergy? And an allergy is something I stay away from. I do not run to. Some people have allergies to shellfish. They may like it, but they stay away from it. They do not. I run to alcohol. I run to drugs. I run to dope. What do you mean I have an allergy? An allergy is an abnormal reaction to a food or a substance. You know, the average temperate drinker, his average reaction, that's a poison. It's a poison. So the average person who, when they get, you get a buzz on, you might know somebody like that. Man, I got a buzz. I'm cool. When I drink, I get thirstier. I smoke while loaded. I get loaded while loaded. You know, I used to think that this allergy, I used to think that it was something bodily different about me. And Dr. Silkworth says something else. He says, we're the only people who have this, what he calls, allergic reaction. If I suffer from the allergy, then I'm probably an alcoholic or an addict. I'm the only this class of people, because it says it differentiates us. It separates me from anybody else. You may know somebody. You may have a boy that was with you when you used to get down. He might have gotten loaded right alongside you. Got married, stopped getting loaded. You know, got fired from a job, got a DUI, I'm cool. I'm not going to let this happen anymore. Doctor told him, dude, if you keep on doing that, you're going to blow your liver out. All right, doc, I'll moderate. I have some buddies now. I have some partners. We used to, the partners that were older partners of mine that turned me out, right, that were smoking weed. They were older than me in school, the ones that put me in the game. And now me and my brother went to a Super Bowl party like 5 years ago, and these cats used to get down just like us. Not all the way to smoking dope, but smoking weed, snorting cocaine, whole nine. Matched, I mean, step for step. Used to get down harder than I did. Went to a Super Bowl party. Me and my brother, who are sober, we went, and there were six other guys. And all these guys used to get down hard. At that Super Bowl party, they had, between the six guys, they had one six-pack and smoked two joints. Me and Ronnie looked at them, and we looked at each other. We know why we weren't getting low. We don't, you know, we know why. And we just looked at each other and said, okay. Because these guys, grown, homeowners, family men, you know, they moved on. I used to think when I came through this phase that I was in, I would move on too. And this phase started lasting longer and longer and longer and longer. And longer. This bodily different thing that goes on with a guy like me, I used to have it confused. I used to think that the reason I got loaded so long was because I have high capacity. That's the body. I figured I was bodily different than my fellows, but the bodily difference is I got high capacity. I'm a Trojan. You guys are, you know, you poop us. If you want to get down with the big boys, this is how we get down, right? That's just the way that I thought it was. Did not know. The doctor calls this allergy, what he says is this phenomenon of craving. When I take one, it sets off something in me. Now, the reason why in our program we have our own language and I have to get accustomed to it is because some of what I think of in everyday language is the opposite in here. Craving, I always thought, was before something happened. My wife had been pregnant. She craved ice cream. I went and got her ice cream, and it satisfied the craving, right? When we come in the rooms, the way the doctor describes my allergy is backwards. The craving happens after I introduce something into me. It took me a minute to get that one rewired in my head. They used to talk about craving, and I always thought, wait a minute, craving, satisfy it, then you cool. No, for us, when I start drinking, I get thirsty. When I start smoking, it sets this thing off of me. If you're a smoker, we should have the least amount of problems with understanding the idea of craving. Because if you're a smoker, we had at least a problem with craving. I ain't never took a hit and then sat up and wondered, damn, am I going to have a, you better pass me the goddamn pipe. You know, it's automatic. It ain't no, it ain't no deliberation. It ain't none of the rest of this stuff. It's me the horn.
We'll get this together.
Okay. Pass me the goddamn pipe. And so that craving deal, so craving, when I take one, anybody else ever be smoking a joint, and I'll have a half a joint right here, and I'm smoking on another one already. This idea of craving that sets off in my body when I take one of anything, well, how do I know I have that? It's the feature that sets me apart from anybody else. How do I know that I have a craving? How do I know that I've ever had a craving? I look at my own experience. Look at my own experience. Don't look at the times you set out to get tore up. Don't look at the times you set out to say, man, she did this to me. I'm just going to tie one on. Anybody ever say, I'm just going to spend 20? Anybody ever spend more than they set out to spend? Craving. Anybody ever say, I'm just going to stop off over here for a minute? Anybody ever stay longer than they intended to stay? Craving. Anybody ever leave their baby with their mom and say, I'm going to be back on Thursday? I didn't say what Thursday, right? Huh? Anybody ever have to pick up the kids from school, stop at your buddy's house just to have one? Just to have one. And ended up not able to pick them up in time. Anybody ever in the motel in the night before you have to get to work and you telling yourself, okay, 5 o'clock, okay, I'm getting ready. 6 o'clock, I'm getting ready. Anybody still in the motel when it's time to be at work? Huh? Anybody have to piss? Know you got to piss? Know you can't piss dirty and still can't not get loaded because you started? Anybody? Phenomenon of craving. I didn't know that when I took one, I'm stuck. When I take one of anything, it sets off something in me. I didn't intend for this to happen. The mothers who left their babies, did you intend to leave your babies? The ones who didn't make it to work, did you intend to not make it to work that day? The ones who couldn't make it to piss, did you intend to miss the piss test when you know you might go to jail that day? The ones who couldn't pick up your babies from school, did you intend for that to happen? The doctor and his doctor's been, it says it causes men and women, you know, this phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon of craving. You know, it sets off things in me that I can't control. So if I have ever experienced the phenomenon of craving, then I am probably alcoholic. You ain't even got to ask yourself no more questions. I got the physical difference. Something physically different about me. But here's the deal. If it was only a physical difference that I had to worry about, we'd have a one-step program. We'd have a Nancy Reagan program. We'd have a just say no program. And it would work. If all I suffer from was a physical allergy, right? If that's all I suffer from, I could say to you, dude, if you don't want to leave your daughter at school no more and have them call and saying she the last one here, just don't take one. And you'd be able to say, oh, shit, damn, cool, I got that. I'm cool. Anybody ever go to treatment and say, I got that? Yeah, shit, I got that. That's easy. Just don't take the first one. Just say no to the first one. I got that. But it's something else that's at work with a guy like me. Something else goes on with a guy named Ralph. And this is this mental obsession. Here's the deal. If you're sitting in here right now and you suffer from what I suffer from, here's my problem. Drugs and alcohol are not my problem. If drugs and alcohol are my problem, I'm probably not alcoholic or addict. Probably a heavy drinker. Drugs and alcohol are my solution. Here's my deal. I can't handle getting loaded. That's the physical. But check this out. I can't handle not being loaded. What happens when I'm not? Doctor described it as restless, irritable, and discontent. I call it, I'm bored. I call it, everybody around me, now they getting on my nerves. I call it, I got to go out to the car and see if I got some roaches in the ashtray. See if I can unroll some roaches. I call it, you know, that thing. Now, I might know that this thing is causing me some problems. Here's the deal about this phenomenon of craving, the physical allergy. For smokers, I don't know if we got any smokers in the house. I'm a smoker. If you're a smoker in the house, you can identify. Smokers intuitively knew something about this allergy. Because as a smoker, you know, you done finally came down, right? You done came down. You done gave up the ghost. You're not going to find nothing tonight. You're not going to hit a lick. Okay, I done finally came down. Now you're in the remorse. I'm not doing this shit no more. You know,
Tard come by the house, and he say, "Ralph, you got a pipe." He ain't got nothing but a nickel. He got a kibble. I already know it's better not to take that a hit of that little, right? I already know. I already intuitively know that it's going to do what? Send me on a mission. I hadn't read the doctor's opinion. I hadn't come to you guys. I didn't know anything about the craving, but I intuitively knew as a smoker. I don't know. I didn't know it as alcohol, but as a smoker, I knew it was better to not set the goddamn monster loose than it was. I knew, but I could not. I could not. He knocked on the door. "Ralph, you got a pipe?" "Yeah, I got a pipe." "What you got?" What we supposed to do with that? "I'm going to give you a bag." I could not take the back. And I know, don't take that back. Don't. You already in for the night. You already. And I take that back and I'm on a mission. Anybody feel me? You know, smokers intuitively knew that. Knew it. And so what? So what is the deal? What made me say yes to it? You know, and that's it. Well, I'm still in the there are things in the phenomenon of craving that'll make you do. And see, that's under, when I already take one, all bets are off. All bets are off. All bets are off. When I already take one, I'm going in purses. When I already take one, I'm crawling. I'm skinny. I'm really skinny. And I got a tall guy that I'm rolling with. And he got a bright idea, middle of the night. I know where this lawnmower is, brand new. He raised the garage door up just enough, and he's squeezing it, middle of the night, it's squeaking. And I crawl under, and I roll it out, and we roll it, a lawnmower up the middle of a goddamn residential street, in the middle of the night, our street, people see. But I'm sprung. I do what I do. I do what I do. Under the phenomenon of craving. But what happens then? What'll make a guy stone sober? Why do I go back to it? Because I can't handle sober either. Doctor says I'm restless, irritable, and discontent unless I can at once experience not the ease and comfort, the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once from taking another one. I admit it's injurious, but after time I can't differentiate the truth from the false. And what is that differentiation anyway? Why can't I differentiate the truth from the false? I got fired from that job, I told you. I got fired from that job because of drugs and alcohol. I got fired from that job because I was too busy getting loaded to make it to work. And when I got fired from that job, can't tell the truth from the false. When I got fired from that job, the reason that I got fired was getting loaded. The first thing I did when I got fired and got that last check, it was a bar two doors down, and I went to the bar. That was my solution to getting fired for following my solution. Can't separate the truth from the false. My solution is I'm going to get loaded. Dude, that's what got you fired. But I can't differentiate the truth from the false. That's my solution. That is not my problem. And it took me many years before I connected that dot. That's my solution. I get high. When you read Bill's story, and that worked for a long time. It worked for a long time. Worked for a long time. This idea of drinking and using. If you're a shy guy like me, it allowed me to do some things I wouldn't have done otherwise. If you're a guy like me, see, drinking and using, sometimes you'll hear people say, and even in my story, sometimes I say it allowed me to say and to do and to be things I wouldn't say do and be without it. But for me, drinking and using did not make me somebody else. It didn't make me taller. It didn't make me. To me, what it seemed like it did was made the real me come out. I was shy, and I was introverted, and I was, but I always felt like, you know, y'all just ain't been introduced to the real Ralph White. And when I got this in me, Ralph could come out and play. I could come out. It made me more me. And it worked for a long time. Got through school, did some successful things, allowed me to take chances I wouldn't take ordinarily. It did some things for me. And for a long time, I stayed stuck in what it did for me. because I'm not one that came out to shoot overnight alcoholic. I didn't come out to shoot overnight addict. I did the progression. And for a long time, I was able to manage and control. I also had some periods, and I also had some things in my recovery that were impediments to my recovery. Smoked angel dust for about a month. Didn't like it. I never connected that piece. Didn't like it. I stopped on my own. Didn't need a program. Didn't need no steps. Didn't need nothing. I'm not doing this shit no more. But the reality, I didn't like it. And I had everything else that I liked doing that I was doing. But as a result of the angel dust experiment, I told myself, when I get tired, I can quit. Well, I never got tired of smoking angels. I just never liked it. But that allowed me to think to myself, when I get tired, I'll quit. And when I started smoking and it started taking me to places it started taking me, I kept thinking to myself, when I get tired, I'll quit. When I get tired, I'll quit. When I get tired, I'll quit. I started thinking this is a phase that I'm in. Then I started thinking, that was in 79, I started hitting the horn. I started snorting in 73. I started hitting the pipe in 79. 84, it got ugly. 85, it got beyond ugly. 86, I was smoking to stop from thinking about where smoking had taken me. Wasn't getting nothing else from it. Smoking to stop from thinking about where smoking had taken me. I was one of them. When Bill Wilson talked about quicksand stretched out all around, I was in the quicksand. And I saw no way out. I'm walking the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm walking the aimless walk. I'm one of those that took me all the way down there. And I got to that point in the first step. The first step is the problem. Without the first step, I don't need any of the rest of the steps. The first step is the problem. And I had the first step in 1985. And I surrendered. And I came to you guys in 1985. And I got some information. And I got some self-knowledge. And I left you guys and I said, thanks for the information. And I started going to meetings, and I would stand at the meeting, and I would go in late, and I would leave early. People would want to give me phone numbers. And I said, oh, I know they want my number. You know, I thought I could help them. Yeah, they want my number. I know they want my number. I thought a guy that was pushing up on me, I'm like, this dude must be gay. I don't know why he's steadily trying to get up on me like that. Like I was a vision for you anyway, right? Like he'd have been choosing me even if he was gay, right? But I'm all tripped out, man. And in 90 days, I got loaded again. And in 90 days, when I got loaded again, I was sitting up here because I knew I was a smoker, but I had a reservation. And in the first step, it talks about there must be no lurking notions nor any reservations whatsoever. And I had a reservation that I could drink and I could sell dope if I got sober, right? And I know nobody else ever had that reservation if they knew. Nobody else ever had the reservation that when I get clean, I can sell dope, right? But I had it. I had it for you, right? So I'm out at this club with this girl who was a friend of mine, my brother's girlfriend. She knew I had had a problem with smoking, and she knew I went in the program. She didn't know anything about when you go in a program, we don't touch anything. So I'm out at this club, and she bought a Long Island iced tea. And I'm looking, and she went out and danced with a guy, and I'm sitting at the table, me and the Long Island. And I'm looking at the Long Island, and it's looking at me. And I sipped the Long Island, because that ain't my problem. I'm a smoker, right? I'm a smoker. Long Island ain't going to do nothing to a guy like me. Shit. So I sipped the Long Island. Then I drank the Long Island. When she came back, I said, I'll get you another one. Then I put my hand on my wallet. I said, why don't you take me home? And I went home and went around the corner, and I went to the dope house, and I started smoking for the next 12 months. And I got a real understanding of my condition. And I understood that in this guy, there's only one I either have a broken regulator or I don't have a regulator. And the regulator, when it comes to Ralph White, is I don't have one when it comes to anything. When I introduced alcohol, I ended up smoking. And I learned that lesson for myself. And I used to go to meetings and I would admit that I was an alcoholic and I would admit that I was an addict. And that came out of my mouth because I liked talking. And I would admit it because it was the price of admission to talk at the podium, right? So I said, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I'm an addict. And I didn't do that. I didn't understand. But when I came back with that ass well whooped, I learned for myself and I conceded to my animal self. This is the first step in recovery. We have a step A that precedes step one. Step one is admitted that I'm powerless. Step A is conceded to my innermost self. And I conceded to my innermost self, and that's when it started for me. I conceded to my innermost self that when I put one in me, no matter where I have to go, what I have to do, or who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over. How do I know my body takes over? From my experience, not yours, not nobody in the meetings, not my sponsors, not the oldest old-timer, none of them. My experience, step one is in my own experience. Step one is a concession I make. Step one is a concession I make based on my experience. Based on my experience. It's not a lot of work to do in the first step. The work is done when I'm out there. I come in here and I give it a name. I give it a name. Instead of me thinking that it's high capacity that keeps me getting loaded, I give it a name. No, it's allergy that keeps you getting loaded. Instead of me coming in here thinking that it's the sixth one, no, it's the first one. It's the first one. You set off a phenomenal craving. And then I find out something else, that when I'm sober, it's untenable for me. When I'm sober, I can't live in my own skin. When I'm sober, I need something to take the edge off. When I'm sober, I need something to jumpstart my day. When I'm sober, the doctor called it restless, irritable, and discontent. When I'm sober, I need something to get Ralph White back to this other, because I've been in that other place for a long time now, and I've seen it as my solution. You know, and I've exercised, and the book won't say it, but it seems to me as if I've been exercising this other muscle memory, this get loaded muscle memory, and it's so deeply embedded in me. You know, that we call that obsession, and that obsession drives out every other thought. You might have left a meeting and got loaded. Somebody will say, how come you didn't call nobody? When obsession come calling, I can't call nobody. And the only reason I'm standing up in front of you this morning is not because I've been able to beat the obsession. It's because the obsession's been lifted. If I've ever been visited by the obsession, you'd have another speaker up here this morning. And so I didn't get to talk about that second part of that first step. I'll probably touch on it in the next session, the unmanageability. But So I'll touch on that in the next session, and let's take a break.